I'm Jill Surgeson, a nurse midwife and researcher fascinated by the concept of trust and its role in our most meaningful relationships. Trust isn't just personal. It influences our health, our communities, and our institutions. In this podcast, we'll explore how trust manifests across different aspects of society, where it thrives, where it breaks down, and what we can do to build it. Through conversations with experts from a variety of disciplines, we'll examine how trustworthiness can lead to a more equitable and fulfilling world. Welcome to Trust Fund. How are you feeling about politicians these days? In my social sphere, even the mere mention of them provokes eye rolling and a sigh of skepticism. And I get it. But I can also attest through years of working in policy that there are some really good people serving as elected officials. There are indeed still politicians with steel spines and soft hearts that work every day to improve the lives of their constituents and beyond. Today, I am so psyched to be talking to one of the best politicians around, North Carolina Representative Julie Von Hafen. Julie has represented the 36th District in the North Carolina House of Representatives since 2019. She's a fierce advocate for North Carolina's public schools and is still a proud member of the PTA at the schools her children attend in Wake County. She is also one of the North Carolina legislature's leading advocates for progressive reproductive health policy and health and social equity. Prior to her service as a state representative, Julie practiced law for over 10 years in a variety of areas, including criminal law, medical malpractice, defense, municipal law, and education law. She's a mom of three, and in her spare time enjoys hiking, kayaking, and is probably the biggest Taylor Swift fan I know.
Thank you, Julie, for being here today. It is a pleasure.
Thank you.
I know that you're mid-session.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently got the week off.
We did, yeah. Kind of unusual. I don't think we've ever gotten a week off in April. So it's a new time at the legislature.
My gain. I wanted to start today because, you know, I've been friends for many years now, just lovely. And I know, although others might, that you did not start your career as a politician. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what inspired you to run for office and how your personal story up to that point shaped the way that you approach public service.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I decided to run, you know, you always have to put together kind of your personal story that when you're out on the campaign trail. So running for office, actually, you have to think it's a little bit retrospective, like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? And how am I going to explain that to people I'm trying to get to vote for me? And I guess I boiled it down to the fact that I feel like I've always been an advocate. Uh-huh. And that kind of showed itself, you know, beginning in high school. You know, I was kind of always the kid that was like writing letters to the editor about things in my community that I felt like were unjust, you know, and I won't go into what those are right now, but it really started there. And then, you know, of course, I went to law school and became a lawyer, which is the ultimate advocate. And that's what lawyers do for a living, is advocate for their clients. And so I worked, you know, being a lawyer for a number of years. And when I had my three kids, I decided to stay home with them. And while I was staying home with them, you know, I'm just the type of person where I can't just sit around and, you know, do nothing. So I got really involved with my kids' school, and that became, you know, my social outlet, but also a place where I really learned to be more of an advocate on like the grassroots organizing level. And I always say, you know, PTA was built on advocacy. It's an advocacy organization. But unfortunately, sometimes gets a bad rap as like, you know, the bake sale moms and people that are, you know, raising money for their school. But it was built on advocacy. And so as part of my work with PTA at my kids' school level, you know, of course, I became like the president of the school PTA and then was the Wake County PTA council president over, at that time, there was about 182 schools in Wake County that pretty much all have PTAs. And so we kind of helped them run their PTAs, and then I served on the state board for the North Carolina PTA, where I became the state advocacy chair. So I was running, you know, all the state level advocacy for North Carolina PTA, and really in 2018, that's when I was approached to run for office. You know, my caucus leadership and our state party leadership saw something in me that was like, you know, you're very connected to your community. You are a great advocate for the issues that you care about. And that's what you want to see in somebody to run for office. And so, you know, I think advocacy has always been at the heart of where I came from before I was in office. And now I really use that lens and how I work in the legislature now.
So when they approached you, was that the moment at what you thought like, okay, I need to do this? Or had you thought that before they actually approached you? Were you working toward that goal? Or was there something specific that happened that kind of catapulted you into this next level of advocacy, which was politics?
At the time, so this going back to 2018, I mean, as you know, that was right after the first Trump presidency. A lot of women are running for office in 2018. And I think that, you know, it definitely was not on, you know, what they say, on my bingo card, you know. It was definitely not on my bingo card that year to run for office. I think at the time I, you know, was upset about like the current trajectory of North Carolina politics, you know, federal politics at the time. And I was thinking, and I knew my PTA days were kind of coming to an end. Like, I didn't know if I was going to run for state president of PTA, like what my next steps are going to be. And so I was already kind of having that, I won't say midlife crisis, but just kind of thinking, what am I going to do next? And when this opportunity came up, I thought maybe this was what I'm supposed to do next. So it was really, you know, kind of destiny, I feel like, in a way. I mean, the timing was exactly perfect for me to run. It was a year that a lot of other women were running. I had a lot of support, and I developed a lot of networks and friendships with the other women that were running that year, which really helped. And then also, you know, I thought at the time I was also thinking, should I run for school board? Because that was, you know, my wheelhouse. That was what I was working in. And so running for the legislature was definitely not something I even ever thought about. But sometimes, you know, you just have to take those opportunities when they come up, and luckily it worked out.
Yeah, it was, you know, at lunch we were talking about how the tables in your life kind of turn from you being an advocate for specific issues to being an advocate for a population, you know, of your constituency, and how a lot of people enter into politics and into these positions without having been formally trained. I mean, you went to law school, but I imagine that there were some assumptions that you came into this role with. And I'm curious about what those were, how those have been affirmed, how those have been stood for you.
Yeah.
Once you got there.
I think coming from advocacy and, you know, I say organizing background, whereas like I was the person that was kind of getting people to go down and have appointments with their legislators. I was telling you a story about the first time that I went to the legislature as an advocate, how nervous I was, you know, how much I felt like I had to prepare and know every data point and, you know, all these things. And, you know, obviously that first time is always the hardest, and then it just gets easier from there. And I think the more that I went to the legislature, I mean, I was even going to Capitol Hill and, you know, advocating there, I realized that the people that I was talking to weren't that at all that intimidating. And you have to kind of think of them as normal people. And I think that now that I'm across on the other side of the desk, so to speak, and listening to people come to talk to me, one of my big goals is to make sure that people understand that like they should not be intimidated to come and talk to me or any legislator or congressional member, whoever you're going to talk to, that we are just normal people. And a lot of the times that we don't know, we don't know as much as the advocate does.
Yeah.
And to really, and I think that's been affirmed to me now, you know, being on the other side, is that, you know, I realize now my colleagues, many of them are not that familiar with a lot of the issues that we talk about. And so I never want anyone to feel like intimidated to come and share your expertise with us, because that's what we need to hear from.
Yeah, I love that. And probably you 20 years ago would have gotten a lot more sleep had you realized that at the time.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been staying up all night before these meetings because
you recognize that now that you were the expert.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're in your fourth term in North Carolina state legislature. And I think your career has really been exceptional in issues around public education, reproductive health, and health and institutional equity, among other things. I'm curious about, from the vantage point that you have now, what do you think the public, or maybe more specifically, like your constituency, expects from someone in your role when it comes to trusting you to do the things that you campaigned and said you were going to do?
I mean, I think as a politician or elected official, you know, one of our biggest challenges is gaining and retaining the trust of our voters and the people that are working for us to get where we are. I think obviously politicians in general have a problem, you know, with trustworthiness, and people don't always, you know, think that we're going to do what we say we're going to do. And I think that that's one of my biggest challenges now being an elected official is retaining that trust. And like you said, you know, I have been reelected 4 times. So I guess, you know, that's a good thing. And I think that that is an indication that people see that I live my values, that I stand for the things that I really care about. They know where I stand on those issues. I never waver from that. And they can trust that. And I think that they know that they can trust that I'm never going to let down teachers and students. I'm never going to let down the women of our state in upholding their right to reproductive freedom. I mean, I get emails all the time from people like, I know how you're going to vote on this, but I just want to tell you, you know, when you, I know how you feel about this, but I just wanted to tell you, thank you. Or, you know, so that means a lot to me because people, even people I don't know personally or I've never met before, they know where I stand. And I think that that is so important in being an elected official and just maintaining that trust, because I think that that's why politicians get a bad rap, is because they say one thing and do another. And that's where you lose the trust of the people that you're representing. That's where you lose the trust of the general populace. But I would never do that. And I think people know that. And I'm never going to go against the values that I stand for.
Mm-hmm. Is that hard sometimes?
Not really. Not for me. I mean, I think that it might be hard for some people. You know, there are certain times, I mean, believe me, as a legislator, we get put into a lot of difficult votes. We get put in a lot of difficult situations. But to me, you know, if people are like, well, I don't know how people are going to think if I vote yes or I vote no on this bill. And I just always go with like my true like gut on something. And if it doesn't feel right, I'm not going to vote for it. And I always feel like if I can justify that, if somebody calls me or emails me and says, I cannot believe that you voted no on this bill. And if I can explain why I voted no in a way that feels good to me and that I feel like is justified, then I never waver, because I'm like, well, at least I can explain that. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody else isn't going to twist around, you know, why I voted on something or imply something or put words in my mouth. I can't avoid that, right? I can never avoid that somebody's going to criticize me or twist something around in a way that's not realistic. But if I personally feel good about the vote and that I can justify it to my own constituents, then I'm good.
One of my favorite stories about you, besides us talking in front of a 20-foot IUD, was several years ago when there had been a particularly devastating vote that had come down in front of an audience of children. And I saw you at the legislature that day, and we went into your office, and you started to cry. And I always had so much respect for you, but it grew because, you know, as a healthcare provider, there have been so many times where I've had to make a call or I've had to stiff upper lip something, but my heart was breaking. And it was because of how much I cared about the impact that was going to have on people I was charged to serve and wanted to serve. And I saw that in you. Specifically that day, I'm sure it's happened other times. Yeah. So we've also gotten to celebrate a lot of your things too, but yeah. I think it just reminded me like how much your heart and soul sits in service to your community. And that's not a face I think that you can show all the time, but it, to me, that exhibit of grief and concern was just such an act of vulnerability that just said all it could possibly say about how seriously you took this commitment to your role. So.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, sometimes, yeah, I mean, just like you said, you can't show that all the time. You can't be like breaking down on the floor and those kind of things. But, you know, the day that you're referring to is the day that, you know, we voted on a really, in my opinion, like dangerous gun bill in front of a bunch of kids who this was going to directly make their communities and possibly their schools less safe. And just the callousness of how we did that, it just broke my heart. And believe me, there's many days that I will go in my office and cry or, you know, be upset. And sometimes I used to feel bad about it, or, you know, sometimes as women, so, you know, we feel like we can't show emotion. But I'm kind of done with that, because I'm like, I also feel like you said, the reason I'm getting so emotional is because I care so deeply about, you know, protecting these kids and protecting our state. And I should never apologize for that.
No, it was beautiful. What is one thing that you feel like people often misunderstand about elected officials that if they understood better could maybe help some of, to restore some of the trust that I feel like is really missing in those relationships?
Well, first I would say that I think just having people understand the process of how legislation happens and the difficulty and the challenges that we face as legislators in getting things passed. Because a lot of times people will be like, well, you're elected, why didn't you do XYZ? You know, or why didn't you get this bill passed? Or why didn't you do this? Or why didn't you do that? And they don't understand literally the ins and outs of how the legislature works and the challenges of getting anything passed there, especially when you're in a position like me in the minority party. I think if people understood that, they would have a lot more respect and grace for politicians, because they would know those challenges. So I think just basic civic understanding of, you know, how bills move through the legislature, and not just like the external things that you see, but the internal politics, yeah, of what goes on in the legislature is shocking, I think, to some people. You know, I always tell the story of, you know, and I'm sure many, many people that were in my position where I flipped my seat from, you know, Republican to Democrat, and I was coming into a Republican-controlled legislature. Well, anybody in that position is coming in at a severe disadvantage to get anything done, because that party doesn't want to see you be successful. And that's continued since I've been there. So I think if people understood those internal politics as well as just externally how bills move and all those kind of things, I think they would have much more grace and understanding for their politicians. And maybe that would result in an increase in trust. I also think that politicians need to be about a lot more connected to their community and be out in the community and make themselves like available to their constituents. I think if people felt that they could talk to them, and, you know, even I was at the gas station the other day, and I have like a house plate on my car, and this guy just started talking to me, and, you know, I introduced myself, and he's like, oh yeah, I've heard of you, you know. And so it's just like those kind of conversations. I'm sure he went home and told his spouse or whatever, oh, I just met our state legislator at the gas station. I mean, that's pretty cool, you know. And so I just think that it would also increase trust if you see the people that are representing you in situations that you can relate to. Like, that's really great.
It reminds me of the People feature, People magazine, like, celebrities are just like, they get gas in their car.
And I don't consider myself a celebrity, but on Saturday I was at the grocery store, and I was going in with my son to get, you know, our Easter dinner stuff. And this lady was like, Julie, she's like, I love you, I follow you on Instagram. And I'm like, whenever that happens and I'm with my kids, they're just like, what is happening? My mom, you're like, you know. And I said, I'm like the local weatherman, like people see me, you know, and they like kind of know who I am, and you know what I'm.
You were saying something to me earlier that I loved, and I was wondering if you could talk about it, about some work that you've done on a piece of legislation called the Omnibus Act here in North Carolina, and how it just keeps being reintroduced. And you were explaining to me why it's important to reintroduce legislation and how a win can look different than just getting something passed. If a wins, these some of these policy wins, to your point about how you have to be kind of at peace with the process. Sometimes you get this huge sweeping bit of legislation passed, but sometimes there are these small wins that over time cumulatively result in the outcome that you want to see.
Yeah. So the Momnibus, if you never heard of it, is a piece of legislation that's based on national legislation that's filed by our representative here, North Carolina, Alva Adams, to increase outcomes for Black women, and it's a Black maternal health bill. And so we have filed, I worked with our local senator, Senator Natalie Murdoch, on this bill since 2021. And so this is the third iteration of the bill that we filed since then. And, you know, we file it every year. Of course, it never goes anywhere. It doesn't get passed. But what I've seen since 2021 is, one, a huge increase in awareness around this issue, which is extremely important, especially for this issue that maybe a lot of people didn't know the disparities between Black and white outcomes in North Carolina and nationwide. But North Carolina happens to be one of the worst in the country. We're rated a D, I think, by the March of Dimes for Black maternal outcomes. And, you know, we've heard all the statistics, you know, 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth, this kind of thing. So, you know, I'm a white woman. I know we're in a podcast, so you might not know what I look like, but I'm a white woman. And so I always feel like it's really important to have this be a multiracial effort. Black women should not shoulder this on their own and should not be the only ones talking about it. So I'm really fortunate that Senator Murdoch has included me. But what I've seen her do, and I would consider myself, you know, I've spoken at many meetings and conferences and met a lot of these community-based advocates that have been doing this work for much longer than we have. And because Senator Murdoch and I have championed this in the legislature, we've seen, fortunately, the ability of us to use our platform to help others raise theirs. And these amazing organizations that are on the ground doing this work, we've started this Black Maternal Health Day at the legislature in the last 3 years, which has grown every single year. We have more and more people coming. We just had a press conference last week, and we had tons of people there. It's just so exciting to see the groundswell and the growth of the movement. And that's why it's important to keep filing these bills. We know that they're not going to get anywhere, but it also helps that when we are finally in a position to get that piece of legislation passed by having a majority in the legislature who supports this work, that we will already have those relationships built. We will already have that coalition built so that when that Momnibus is passed, hopefully someday, we're ready to go. We're ready to like push it out. We're ready to, you know, have all these groups apply for the money we're going to get appropriated. We're going to have, you know, we're going to be ready to go. We're going to have those relationships established. And that it takes a long time sometimes for these things to happen. And I think that's the other thing when we're talking about trust, is that I think people don't trust politicians because they think we can just like snap our fingers and things happen overnight. And that's just not reality. That's not how it works. It takes years for these things to grow and get established. And so that's the Momnibus is a great example of that, because we've been building that momentum now for 4 years, and it's going to keep growing. People know about the bill more, and it's just been a great thing to see.
I also think you found something important, which is one of the common definitions of trust that I really like is that belief that someone else is acting in your best interest. And I think sometimes there is the perception, which is not always inaccurate, that people, elected officials, are just hopping on the topic du jour and they're going to just run with it for one, you know, session, see how much it gets them traction. And then if it doesn't get anywhere, then and it's not sexy enough or whatever, then they're just going to let it go. And so I think the trust is built, like that first season or that first session, yeah. But the fact that you operated in the best interest once, and that you do it again and again and again, it's reinforced that this is not some political stunt. This is a real commitment to the issue, to the people. And when you look at trust literature, that's one of the most solidifying factors in building trusting relationships, is being able to see the behavior exhibited over and over again. And so I think that's another part of some of the efforts that you've had here in North Carolina that maybe haven't had these super glamorous wins because you're in the minority party, but have allowed people to feel that they trust that you and many of your colleagues are working in their best interest.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, I feel like, yeah, when I first started maybe doing this work, you know, maybe some of these groups and the people were like, well, what is this person getting involved with this? You know, whether it's because I'm white or because I didn't have the experience they did, or, you know, whatever it was. And I had to build that trust with them too, not just with my constituents, but with the advocates I'm trying to work with. And I do think that showing up for them year after year after year, and not always in the public eye either.
That's another thing.
You know, always
going behind the scenes, yeah. Anytime.
I mean, I go and visit these places. I go and have meetings with people, and those are not on the news or like in a press conference room. These are one-on-one conversations, you know, learning about the work that they're doing on the ground. You know, like Mame here in Durham, you know, like I've been to their house, you know, where they do their work and met with, you know, the staff and, you know, all that stuff. So I can more deeply understand what they're doing. And that is not sexy. Like you said, that's not something I have to do, but I know it's important to develop trust with them and all the other groups so that they see I'm not just doing this for attention or flash in the pan. This is something I deeply care about, and they can see that.
Absolutely. That being said, a lot of times you do get to work with these organizations that are immediately value aligned and things like that. But I'm curious about whether you've had a policy win, whether it's actually a passage of a bill or something just even less notable than that, but a policy win that has involved kind of a reaching across the aisle, like some coalition building or relationship building with people that you might not normally be super aligned with, and then you were able to build something really positive out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say those issues, it's never going to be kind of the more controversial things, you know, that like, you know, you hit like reproductive rights or, you know, I don't know, LGBTQ rights. Like, you're never going to get like some coalition yeah. building on those kind of issues. But I mean, I always say, like, people are always surprised, like, I think it's like 90% of the bills in the legislature are passed unanimously. So, like, a lot of those issues are, like, super boring things, like, people, like, wastewater, you know, or, like, things that people don't really care that much about, that controversial. So, I think I will say that it's getting harder to do that. I mean, in our political environment, it is getting harder to find those touch points where you can work across the aisle. And, you know, we talked about that I'm very firm on like my values. So for me personally, it's sometimes hard for me to put aside all the things I might know about somebody to work with them on this one particular issue, because I find it very hard to like
hold your nose.
Yeah. And some other electeds are better at that. And I think that's fine. I think that we all have to operate in the space how it feels good for us. And some people, I say, are bridge builders, and other people are not. I look at myself more as a truth teller. I think there's truth tellers and there's bridge builders in this work. And it's okay not to be one or the other. And it's also okay that sometimes you are a truth teller on certain issues, and then other times you can be a bridge builder on certain issues. So, for example, like when I first started, I did find a couple of people across the aisle that were willing to work with me on some environmental issues, because there are some more conservative members that are like, they want to advocate for clean energy and some environmental regulation and things like that. And so I was able to meet with them on a couple of things, like small things like around electric vehicles and like trying, you know, at that time, you know, EVs, you know, were even less popular than they are now. And so just trying to, you know, build that industry in North Carolina. So I was able to get a couple of bills passed through the House on a bipartisan bill that I sponsored with, you know, people across the aisle. But honestly, the number of those people who are willing to work with us on things are getting smaller and smaller. And I think that's just a reality of the political environment. The other thing is that when we're talking about trust, sometimes it's hard to trust that they will help you because they do everything in their power not to on other issues. So it's very hard for me sometimes to trust that they have like their heart in the right place. And then maybe they feel that way about me.
I was going to say, does it go both ways?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm not going to say it's all, you know, them. I mean, I'm sure they feel that way. And so, like I said, I just think that's a symptom, unfortunately, of the political environment we're in right now.
I do appreciate that candor. And I love how you call yourself a truth teller. You have a really brief quote that I love that I was reading, and you said, responsible governance requires accountability. Taxpayers deserve to know what happens to their tax dollars.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of people say that. We don't see a lot of that. And I've seen a lot of that in your work. And I was wondering if you could, I heard this called a magic wand question last week, but it is sort of that. So, you know, if you could have the magic wand that could have influence one structural change to make politics more transparent or accountable, even person-centered, what would that be?
Well, one thing, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, I mean, there's lots of different things I think we need to do at the legislature here in our state to make it more transparent and accessible to people. Mm-hmm. There's so many barriers right now to people accessing or participating in government. You know, whether that means we have like committee meetings at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday that nobody can come to, we have no ability to weigh in, you know, online. Yeah, or we have no, you know, or we have sessions in the middle of the night. We have no way for people to like sign up to give public comment. Some states have, you know, portals where you can submit public comment on bills and then legislators can read it. So there's all of that. But I would say the one thing that, you know, we should do, and we've actually filed bills around this, is, you know, our state budget is a document and a blueprint of values in our state. And it's right now, it's written behind closed doors, and it's written by a very small number of people. Like, I'm talking 5 to 10 people in this whole state are writing the state budget that's going to spend $60 billion of your taxpayer money. And we have no idea how this document is being put together, who's influencing it, who's, you know, asking for $100,000 for this group, $200,000 for this. We have no idea. So the one
we, you mean
the taxpayers.
Yeah. Or yeah,
North Carolinians, like whether you're in or out of the legislature. I mean, like nobody
knows. No one.
Yeah. Even people in the party that the majority party that's writing it, he says that them don't know how this is happening. So it's just crazy to think about. So the one bill that we filed, which I think is a great idea, is that everything in the budget that has a directed appropriation, whether that's like to a town, whether that's to a nonprofit, whether that's to a crisis pregnancy center, whether that's to anything, has to have the name of the legislator attached to it that asked for that money. I mean, it's a simple idea that it would give so much more transparency to know, because I think your quote, I was on a op-ed or something I wrote on crisis pregnancy centers, because we're giving away millions of dollars to these places and we have no, you know, accountability for how it's spent. You could say the same about like private school voucher program. And I get asked by the press all the time, who is leading the charge to get this money for crisis pregnancy centers? And I would say, I had no idea. Because we don't know who is putting this money in the budget, who's asking for it, and nobody will fess up to it, you know? And so that would be a great way to give accountability, to know at least who is behind all these appropriations, these directed appropriations in the budget.
So there's sort of the great and powerful Oz behind this curtain.
Yep.
And I think that's really, really compelling. I did not know that. I'm a little shocked.
So, yeah.
But I think when we're going back to like how we win the trust of the people, I mean, that goes both ways, because I'm sure there are some things that show up in budgets that people would not support the elected official if they had known that they had put that in.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, I think, have trust in elected officials if you don't have access to, because you have access to the bills, right, that they've sponsored and how they voted. But if you don't have access to the full range of their actions, it's hard to trust that they're always working in your best interest back to this, or at least mostly working in your best interest, acknowledging that no one can do this job and please every single person. But that step toward transparency is, it seems like a no-brainer. I'm wondering what the opposition is to this, besides the obvious one, which is that people don't want to have to deal with being accountable for it.
I mean, I'm not going to say why they wouldn't do it, but I could guess that that's why. I mean, I don't know. I get asked that a lot. Like, why do they do this? Why do they do it? I'm not going to, like, put myself into their shoes other than to guess why, you know, they do these things. And I mean, unfortunately, the best guess is a bad reason, you know, in my opinion, that they want to keep it secret. There's a reason why they're doing that. And, you know, I just think, like you said, it erodes that trust in elected officials when you don't know, one, who's influencing them.
Yeah.
You know, we know that there's so much money in politics. You know, lobbyists are swarming all over the building, you know, wanting this or that. And, you know, we really have no way of knowing how elected officials are being influenced, or why they're asking for certain things. And like you said, I think some voters and constituents might not always like what they're trying to get money for.
So you have had an excellent record of re-election, obviously, you know.
Thank you.
But this doesn't mean that everyone in your district supports you. It doesn't mean that everyone listening to this podcast will support your policies. And that's the trouble, right? We want to have good civil discourse and disagreement. But I'm curious, I can imagine as an elected official, there would be some tension in knowing that. And I'm curious about how you hold yourself accountable to the communities and the constituents that you serve, especially those who didn't vote for you, or those who may feel left out of your priorities or your process.
I mean, when I first ran, you know, for office, the one reason I think I ran was because the person that was representing me, I didn't feel was doing their job in a way that I felt like they should. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I would try to reach out to them and, you know, they were not of the same political party. So, like, you know, I didn't agree with most of the things that they were doing. So, you know, I would try to reach out to them and I never got a response. You know, I felt ignored. And so I don't know if that was because we held different opinions on topics or different values or different political parties. You know, I don't know if that person only responded to people they agreed with. So I very much hold myself, you know, I very much am committed to responding to every person that reaches out to me, whether I agree with them or not. And if I don't agree with them, I explain, well, I don't agree with, you know, your position. This is why. But thank you for reaching out and telling me your opinion. I think that is one of my biggest jobs as an elected official, is to always respond, you know, and I'm not always going to say that I agree with that person. I think that is not genuine and it's not honest, you know. And so I think that when people look at elected officials, they want somebody who's going to be honest with them. And whether that means just telling them straight out, well, I'm not going to agree with you on this, but I do appreciate you sharing. And I think in my years of campaigning, especially in knocking doors, I've knocked thousands of doors over the years in my district. Those conversations, the one thing I've learned is that people just want to be listened to.
Yeah.
They don't really care if you agree with them necessarily or not. And the one thing I've also learned is that I don't always have to have the answers either. Like, if somebody says to me something and I'm like, well, you know, I don't know a lot about that topic, but tell me what you know, and then I'm going to learn more. And I think that goes a long way for people, because I think politicians think that they always have to have the answer, or they have to come up with some flip response on the spot. And that came up the other day. Like, housing policy is very complicated, for example, and I don't know anything about housing. This is not in my, that's not in my background. It's not anything. I mean, I've learned more about it since I've been in the legislature. But anytime a housing group comes and talks to me, they're like, what do you think about X, Y, and Z? I'm like, I don't know. I'm sorry, I just don't know. And I said, I'm going to learn more about it. I'm going to be educated on it. And please help me. And I think that really people respect that. They don't want you to be like, act like you know everything. Because then you want those people walk away and go, they didn't know anything. Like, they just made that all up.
Yeah.
And then you just don't have that level of respect for that person, you know. And so I think that, you know, that I'm just, I really make myself available to my constituents. I'm always willing to meet with anybody. I mean, I meet with, you know, anti-abortion groups. I met with Moms for Liberty. You know, these are groups that I adamantly disagree with on pretty much everything. But I think they respected the fact that I took the meeting,
sure.
You know, and I sat with them and listened to their opinions. And I knew that they probably knew I wasn't going to change my opinion. But I hope that that at least, you know, went a little way to like have them respect the fact that I'm willing to listen.
I love that so much. And it comes up in a lot of the work that I've done around what does it mean to be trustworthy? And so much of that is exactly what you've described, and is like, you know, it's about showing respect. It's about being willing to listen, not to just hear, but to genuinely offer considerate attention to what's being presented to you, to hear these stories, to respond in a professional and timely way. Because I think that that's what people really want. And I've said this other podcasts I've recorded, and I say this to my kids, like, people just want to feel seen. And in my opinion, as not an elected official, as just a citizen, taxpayer, whatever, there are a lot of policies that are being pushed right now. And I think I don't agree with many of them. Some I do, but I think that the frustration is partly what the policy is. The other bit of the frustration, I think the bulk, is feeling like there was no real civil, educated discourse around the decision, and things that affect people's lives weren't carefully considered. And once something can be carefully considered, there is a feeling of mutual respect, I think, that happens. And then that, again, contributes to the trust. But, and I've said this in healthcare too, like, it is really, I think, the elected official's responsibility to exhibit these qualities to engender trust from their constituents.
Bam.
It's not the constituent's burden to trust you simply because you were elected.
Right. And I think that's just, we've got it turned around right now, that I think there's just a lot of people that are serving in elected office that just feel like because they were elected that they just automatically deserve people's trust. And the other thing is, in North Carolina especially, there's only like a certain number of districts, for example, like in the legislature, that are truly competitive. So like a lot of these people are getting into elected office either running unopposed, you know, where they didn't have to really justify their positions, or they're running in such an area where maybe they don't have a lot of that like pushback on some of their policies. But they also have to remember they're passing laws for the entire state of North Carolina. Like, if it's something that's just affecting your district, that's one thing. But most of the things that we are passing in the legislature affect all 11 million people in North Carolina, and they don't really like understand that it doesn't just affect the people that have elected them or the people that may be in their stratosphere, but like everybody. And they need to listen to everybody, not just like the people in their own backyard. And I think that that's where we've gotten away from that discourse. And I was trying to think of this quote I saw the other day, something like, normalize not having an opinion on something you know nothing about.
Imagine.
Yeah. And I just think we've forgotten that. Like, you don't have to have an opinion on it if you don't know anything about it. And if we normalize that, I think that would take away a lot of the bad policies that are being passed on issues that, you know, like, for example, women's health care, that like a lot of these men know nothing about. that they normalized, you know, having to have an opinion on that, and we should not.
But I love that. My sister says a lot of the times about things, she'll say, often wrong, never in doubt.
Exactly. Yes, that happens a lot at the legislature.
And I appreciate what you're saying about holding that broader responsibility. You know, like, you could have children who go to your school, and of course you run that school, let's say you're the principal, obviously in a way that you would want your children to benefit from, but you also run it in a way that you'd want all the children to benefit from, right? So, I do think that we have to think about how we can hold our elected officials accountable for the greater scope of their responsibility, how we can encourage with campaigning, governing, the demonstration of these qualities that you were talking about. So we really want to thank you for coming today. And I want to leave with one question, because I wouldn't want your job right now or anyone's out on, and I think no one will disagree that this has been a really, really difficult few months. And I'm curious about what keeps you going when the system feels slow or broken or threatened. And that can be something very personal to you. That can be something related to your job. But what keeps Julie ticking and running for office again and showing up?
Oh, there's many things, and I get this question a lot, but I mean, I would say one, it's I do feel a calling to be a voice in that building for people who can't be there, whether it's kids, you know, whether it's teachers that are at school teaching our kids, whether it's, you know, healthcare professionals who are literally, you know, taking care of people, but we're passing policies that, you know, affect them and their patients. It could be a number of people, but I do feel like I'm in a position, and I'm fortunate enough to be there and be able to do this job, and I think do it effectively. And I just feel this very much like calling or whatever it is to be there and just keep speaking out about these issues. And there's just not a lot of people who can do the job that I do, and I feel like I can do it. And so I just feel like I need to be there doing it. I would say the second thing is the people that I meet, and like, you know, I'm fortunate in my position to be able to meet so many incredible advocates, community organizations, normal people who are doing the harder work in some ways, I feel like, you know, and it's those boots on the ground people like Mom A, like, you know, Equity Before Birth, you know, all the education groups I work with, the teachers that I meet, you know, all these people who are doing the work that we are up there like passing laws about. And they keep me motivated, because I'm like, okay, I need to keep fighting for them. And so it's like, I have so many stories of like the incredible people that I've met and the incredible things that they've done. And it's just that those are the people that like keep me going, because I'm like, if they can do that work, like I can certainly like go up a couple days a week to Raleigh and fight for them and fight for the issues that we all care about. And, you know, just on a personal level, of course, you know, I have three kids of my own and I want to see a better North Carolina for them. And so, yeah, it's for all those reasons that I keep doing it. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for today. Thank you for your amazing service and all the ways that you have just made my heart swell with pride in the years that I've known you and all the good that you've done for North Carolina. So
thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, before you go, here's a shameless plea. If you like this episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast. That way you'll never miss a new episode. You can also find more about us at trustfundpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you loved what you heard, I trust you to leave a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Trust Fund is a production of Jill Surgeson and the Duke University School of Nursing.